Thank you very much. It has been probably 10, 12 years that I've been in this area, learning about the stories of this area, and it's been an honor for me to be working and sharing this platform today with people like Danny Walkowitz and Carol Turbin. Their books on the workers of Troy and Cohoes first introduced me to those important local workers and their stories, and their research really laid the groundwork for all the work that's happened since. It's also a pleasure to talk after Kathy Sheehan at the Historical Society, because she always has great information to share, and every time I'd go to the Rensselaer County Historical Society, she'd have found a new treasure back in those archives. Once I heard a famous biographer speaking at a conference, and she said that being a historian is one of those few professions where you're not only allowed, but you're encouraged to read someone else's mail. It's legal. And I suppose being a private detective is another one of those careers where you get to rummage through someone's private papers and speculate about who this person was and what kind of life they led. That's what we're all talking about today. We've been rummaging through the lives of the past, and there's some limitations to the materials that you have to work with. If you think back to the history books we all had in school, the stories we learned about were sort of the great white fathers, the rich men, the manufacturers, the big politicians. In many ways, history belongs to those who leave the most paper, the records, those who had the time or the training or the opportunity to record their thoughts, those whose activities are carried out in the public eye and they get recorded by newspapers or official city historians, or those who have great big attics and generations of family papers that they can store and they don't move, so they stay in that attic. And maybe the key is that there's a family that doesn't clean the attic and throw everything out. I think every historian has stories of the great treasures that were lost by some family member who wanted to clean things up. So most of us don't leave a lot of tracks in the sand of our lives. We don't have a long paper trail, but we have families, and the families share stories of Aunt Mary or our grandfather or the local legends, the stories of our own community. Now, traditional cultures like the Hopi or the Iroquois Indians have officially designated storytellers. These are people whose job is to memorize verbatim the story of our people, and they recite it to generation after generation, and each generation of storytellers trains the next generation, so that story is carried on intact exactly as it was passed on to them. Unfortunately, in our American culture, those stories only get passed on if somebody is interested in receiving it and interested in looking into it and recording it. And if you have no family to save the papers or to carry on the stories, if you're an immigrant or someone who spoke a foreign language, if you're a working class person, a poor person who moves a lot, someone who owns no real property, no real estate, or a woman who happens to have this habit of changing her name every time she gets married, all of those cases, your story can get lost over time. And that certainly was the case with Kate Mullaney. She kind of fits all of those categories. Although she spoke English, she didn't speak Irish. So once in her lifetime, Kate was known about people throughout the Northeast, certainly, probably farther afield. But by the mid-1900s, she's sort of a footnote in history. So briefly, the story today I'm going to share with you is the story of finding Kate. It's a search I've been spending a lot of time off and on for a number of years. And unfortunately, it's a story that as soon as I think I find answers, I also find more questions. If any of you have done local genealogy, you know that's the nature of the beast. It keeps on growing in terms of the areas you need to explore. Now, I know Danny Walkowitz and Carol Turbin both encountered Kate Mullaney in their research, but I think one of the earliest people who brought her to public notice was a graduate student in Reverend Tom Phelan's course up at RPI, a woman named Nancy Duquette, back in the early 70s, and she did a paper on Kate Mullaney. Now, for many years, the only hard facts we had on Kate Mullaney was in the 1870 Troy City Directory, she's actually listed as a cooperative collar manufacturer, with her offices in Union Block and her home on 8th Street, 358th Street. In that census of 1870, Kate is listed along with her family members at that address in that household. But that's pretty much been the extent of where the trail led. To find out more, we had to go backwards and forwards from 1870. I looked in all the different city directories of Troy, charting anyone with the name Mullaney. Also looked at state and local census records. Now, city directory in the 1800s is pretty much like a phone book today. It lists everybody's name and address, but like everybody knows, a phone book is only accurate the day it comes off the printing press, and even then it's usually out of date. And often there'll be mistakes. Names are spelled incorrectly, the phone number may not be right, the address may not be complete. And if you're using city directories, you have to be creative. How many different ways can you spell Mullaney? How many different ways could they put her in a different house? What initials might be this person? In the 1850s, Irish immigrants, of course, were extremely numerous here. Many of them spoke Gaelic, but all of them had a very different accent. And the spelling, it ranges all over the map. Mullaney actually was fairly consistently spelled M-U-L-L-A-N-Y, and that's actually why we ended up using that spelling in the actual designation. Then, as in now, married couples were only listed under the man's name. Women were only listed if they were the head of the household, meaning usually they were a widow with children, or they had boarders, or occasionally they would be an independent worker boarding somewhere. But women are very difficult to trace because they do change their names and they're not always listed. I actually traced the listings for all of Kate's family members, and her older sister Mary never got married. And it was actually because Mary Mullaney died as Mary Mullaney, I could actually find a death date, which led me to an obituary, which led me to sister of the late Catherine Fogarty. So finally I had Kate's married name, the Fogartys. Then I could go back into the directories checking Catherine Fogarty, and that led me to other obituaries in the local newspapers, local church records, cemetery records, and even got into court records. And in the end, it was the house, the actual physical real estate at 358th Street, that led to some of the most interesting information, because there again, it's real property that had to be passed on to descendants, and therefore their property deeds and surrogate court records. So who was Kate Mullaney? Let me give you a quick rundown. There's always more details, and I won't give you every second of her life, because I don't know every second. But Catherine Agnes Mullaney was born in England somewhere in around 1841. I must say that the dates, like many women, Kate doesn't necessarily age 10 years every 10 years. So, you know, 10 years pass with the census and she's only 6 or 7 years older. But she's reported to be 65 at her death. So assuming she's correct in her death date, her age at death, we think she was born around 1841. Her parents were Irish. Born in Ireland, Dominic and Bridget Mullaney. And apparently the family name Mullaney is fairly rare in Ireland. It seems to be only in the county Sligo that you find that name. And Richard Mullaney, a lawyer up in Saratoga Springs, told me that the name is actually a derivation, a 16th century derivation of a French name. So maybe the Mullaneys originally came from France to Ireland, and then they lived in County Sligo. We don't know when the family moved to England. It certainly was before the Great Famine of the 1840s, because Mary, Kate's older sister, was born in England in 1838. The family probably was working in the mills in 1838, or the father, in England. Mary Elizabeth was born in England, then Catherine Agnes, and then another sister, Bridget Teresa, born around 1845. Now, there may have been brothers in the family, there may have been additional sisters, but these are the only three names that I see consistently in the household. And in fact, in Bridget, the mother's will, only those three girls are named. curiously, in the 1870 census, there are three other Mulaneys listed in the household. There's an Ellen, who's just a little bit younger than Bridget, an Alice, and a Frank. They never appear before then. They never appear after them. So they may be relatives. They may be boarders that the census taker just sort of gave the same last name. This is one of the mysteries. Now, Kate's father, Dominic, first shows up in the Troy directories in 1852. So we know he at least came to the area by then. He was a laborer, probably working in any of the many industries of this area, possibly in the railroad, possibly in the canals. There may have been other family in the area that they came to live with. There were some property deeds that Bridget Mulaney, the mother, had with some Mulaneys in the city of Rensselaer in the 1850s, John, Thomas, Michael, and Charles Mulaney. Thomas was a laborer here as early as 1851. Charles was a fireman, and Thomas and John were both switchmen on the railroad. So they, and actually all three men were on the railroad in the 1850s. And by 1865, John and Thomas ran a grocery store on Wendell Avenue or Wendell Street in Rensselaer, what was then called Greenbush. So if these were indeed uncles or cousins, Kate Mulaney had family in the area, and she in particular had family who ran a grocery store, a valuable connection if you're going to be on strike and not having income. Kate and her mother and sisters all lived in the Collar District of Troy. They were faithful attendants at St. Peter's Catholic Church. In the 1860 census, Bridget, the mother, is listed as peddling dry goods, sort of a door-to-door salesman of some sort. Mary was a seamstress. Kate worked out, which meant she worked in factories, not that she was a weightlifter. And the family, and then of course the youngest daughter, Bridget, was still in school. She was only 15. At that point in time, they had no real estate, but they had accumulated $150 worth of private property or private accounts. So they actually had some savings. So Bridget must have been a good peddler, and her father was still alive but not listed as resident in that census, so maybe he was working on, again, perhaps the railroad out of town, perhaps the enlargement of the Erie Canal, which was expanded in the 1860s. By 1864, though, Dominic has died, and the year that he dies, Kate's mother buys some cemetery plots. The father and the mother are not buried there, but that's where Kate ends up. In the 1860s, the family seems to move frequently. A lot of times it's 34 2nd Street, 34 North 3rd Street. And it's possible they were in a back alley between the two streets. It was in a multiple unit building. There were three families in that one building, so definitely apartments. Now, Kate Mulaney, as you've heard before, and we'll hear again, no doubt, worked in the Collar Laundry, 12 to 14 hour days, seems like 8 days a week, certainly more than an eight-hour day, certainly more than a six-day week, working in extremely demanding physical conditions and earning $3 to $4 a day. As Carol was saying, to be an ironer was extremely skilled, took a lot of physical dexterity, so I sort of picture Kate being a strong, sturdy person. Again, we have no photos of her. In 1864, she organized the Collar Laundry Union and managed to get 300 women from 14 different laundries to join together to strike and to organize for their rights. Apparently, she did this with great encouragement and following the example from the Iron Molders Union, which had had a strike that same year. And they actually demanded a 25% wage increase, and they were successful. They also had some current concerns about starching machines that were introduced, and I'm not quite sure how that was resolved, but they definitely got the wage increase. That wage increase, the strike and the increase were in February. By July, the Women's Lake Laundry Union were in attendance at this national labor picnic in Troy. This was the Troy Trades Assembly kickoff. And the women of the Collar Union actually made a very large, very ornate banner, which they presented in appreciation to the iron molders. So clearly, from the beginning, the two unions were tightly connected. And in fact, if you look at the neighborhood where the household structures, many of the women are working in the collar factories, in the laundries. Many of the men are working as molders or in the foundries. Now, I should say that Kate Mullaney did not form the first women's union in America. There were earlier unions in Lowell. The women there actually formed unions and had strikes. Even over in Harmony, the weavers had a successful strike and a union that was formed in 1849. What was different was that the collar laundry union never gave up being a union. Most other unions would form, strike for a particular issue, win, and then go back to work. And that was the end of it. It was sort of like the union only was needed when you needed it. And other times, they would let it slide. Kate Mullaney and the women's labor union, laundry union, maintained that union for 5 years. Even when they weren't on strike, they were still organized. They had one of the largest treasuries among unions. They provided benefits not only in times of strike, but if workers were injured on the job or if there were deaths in the family, that money from the union would actually help support the family and support those union activities. They also supported unions outside of the laundry union. They were very active with the iron molders. As you heard, in 1866, when the iron molders were on strike, they actually donated, I wrote down the number, I knew I wouldn't remember it, they donated $1,000 for the iron molders strike. Astronomical. I mean, 200 was big enough, but 1,000, if you consider you're making $14 a week, that's an outstanding amount of money. And in fact, after that donation, the Troy Trades Assembly actually invited the women's laundry union to be affiliated with them, and they made a point of adding women's books to the free union labor library in the reading room that the Trades Assembly had set up. So that the women of the labor union all worked together and worked with the men in their unions. Now, this is interesting because this is a time in the mid-19th century when women were not allowed to gather in public. There was no local diner you could go and do your organizing. The union halls were open only to men. Most of the women's organizing were probably done on the street corner, maybe at the workplace when the boss wasn't around, and more likely at home, in the private homes. And this is another reason that we could argue the national significance of Kate Mullaney's house on 8th Street, because it was probably at that kitchen table that the women got together and plotted out their strategies. The family had actually bought the land on 8th Street for that house in September of 1864, only 6 months after they won their first strike. And they built the house in the next 2 or 3 years. They probably moved in by the end of 1868. The house was designed to be an income-producing property. It's a double-row house, 3 apartments, 1 per each floor. And from day one, it's got a family renting each floor. The family lived probably the upper apartment at 350, and they rented out apartments and the rest of the house. Again, a separate set of income, another source of money when you're out on strike. 1866, they actually had another strike in the laundry union, and they actually got a pay raise to $14 a week, which was pretty much on par with men at the time, astronomical amount. 1866, the National Labor Union, as you've heard before, grew out of this Congress convened by William Silvis. William Silvis had been at that picnic where the collar laundry had brought the banner, and clearly had met and talked and knew Kate Mullaney. 1868, the strike once again, another increase and more equal pay for increased work demands. And in 1868, the New York Sun, again, the New York City newspaper, interviews Kate Mullaney and publishes the story of this remarkable union with over 500 members that's been in existence at that point by 4 years. And then that's where you heard Carol's story about the women who, if you don't have women who can organize unions, we've got them here in Troy. We'll pay their way and let them help you. She certainly wasn't shy about her skills and her workers. In September 21st of 1868, the second session of that National Labor Congress down in New York City had their convention, and they elected Kate Mullaney the second vice president of this National Labor Union. Now, there was a little bit of paperwork in that the first vice president was also from New York State, and somebody brought up a obscure rule that you couldn't have two officers from the same state. So Kate Mullaney didn't actually hold that job, but she was appointed as the special assistant secretary to coordinate national working women's associations. So she is the first woman in America to hold a national job at a national labor union level. And in fact, when William Silvis introduced her in the vote for this Congress, he said, "She's one of the smartest and most energetic women in America. And from the great work she's already done, I think it not unlikely we may in the future have delegates representing 300,000 working women." Now, from my understanding, the national labor union records have been lost or incomplete over time. So we don't know, or I don't know, and if anyone out there knows more, please let me know. We haven't really documented how much Kate did on a national level. Where did she go with other unions? We do know that in 1870, the seven women's unions in New York State actually organized the Working Women's State Labor Union of New York. So Kate clearly stays involved. 1868, 1869 was, of course, the big strike by the Collar Laundry Union, and this was the strike to have the right to organize. And this was also the strike where the manufacturers of collars actually united and created an association to break the union. Esther Keegan and Kate Mullaney went to New York City. The Working Women's Association gave very little money, but every other local in New York City gave aid for that strike. This strike here and the brickmakers' strike for the eight-hour day in New York City were the only two strikes with official state sanction in 1869. Again, a labor picnic. Often you see references to labor picnics and gatherings where they would get together, raise money for the union. Here they raised $1,200. Kate starts a cooperative collar and cuff laundry initially, thinking that we'll directly compete as a laundry. The collar manufacturers united and blocked all shipments of laundry of collars to her to wash. So they went the next step and formed their own factory. And this was the factory that Susan B. Anthony came to visit. And this is the factory that she's listed in the city directory of 1870 as being the runner of it. And then that factory, again, I don't know exactly when, but by 1873, the cooperative factory has gone out of business, couldn't compete. And Kate Mullaney seems to have disappeared from history. 1875, in the state census, the family is still living at 350 8th Street, and in fact, there's some crossing outs of names in the family listing, and there's a woman named Bridget that's actually Kate's age working in Kate's occupation, back in the laundry worker, and that's probably Kate Mullaney. Bridget, at this point, is married, lives next door in an apartment. She's got her own married name, and we don't know whether Kate gave her name as Bridget or the census taker was careless, but I'm pretty sure Kate Mullaney still was working in the laundries in 1875. 1876, her mother dies. Don't know where she's buried. She's not buried up at St. Peter's Cemetery. And in Bridget Mullaney's will, she leaves her three properties. By now, they own the double row house at 350, 352 8th Street and a small wooden house at 356. It's now an empty lot. Those three properties are left to each of her three daughters, and they're bequeathed along with the rental income and profits arising from renting those buildings. Somewhere around 1877, Kate marries. She marries a man named John Fogarty. There are about 8 John Fogartys listed in the city directories. My guess, again, speculation, there's a John Fogarty who shows up in 1877 who is a puddler. Highly skilled, unionized occupation. I suspect he's a union man, and we have a union marriage. Kate probably lives at his house, we assume. She's no longer listed, and there are no Fogartys listed on 8th Street. He lives down by the Albany Iron Works, so it's possible he's a puddler down at either Burden or Albany Iron Works. We don't know what Kate's involvement is in future years. Certainly in 1886, there is that strike by the collar members, the collar women, in the Joan of Arc Assembly. You heard a bit about that from other speakers. That actually was the largest women's local in the nation, that Knights of Labor chapter here in Troy. 250 laundresses were locked out, 15,000 in the industry were affected, and unfortunately the executive, John Hayes, from the Knights of Labor, acceded to the manufacturer's requests without the workers' assent, according to some newspaper articles. And the strike ended, and actually most collar girls apparently in the next 2 months quit the Knights of Labor in great disgust. So there's a chapter that's yet to be fully researched. From then, we only know a few basic facts. 1898, the 3 properties on 8th Street were sold for back taxes and assessments. The Fogartys and their nephews and one niece actually moved to Buffalo. We find them in Buffalo for the next 4 years. John Fogarty ends up down in Pittsburgh. He moves to Pittsburgh around 1878 and dies there in 1904. Again, that would fit with being a molder or puddler or some worker in the iron industry. Kate stays in Buffalo until 1903 and then comes back to Troy and lives with her sister Mary. 1905, there's a major strike by the collar starchers union. Again, unfortunately, ends in a defeat, but was successful in its time. And the little we know of that strike is at least 2 of the leaders of it, a Rose Byron and Katie Fitzgerald, both lived within 1 block of Kate Mullaney's house. It makes you wonder who else was working on that kitchen table and sitting around talking about what can we do for the workers. The following year after that strike, in August of 1906, Catherine Mullaney Fogarty dies at the age of 65, dies actually of an intestinal ulcer, peritonitis, and she's listed at her death as a starcher. It's interesting that all 3 newspapers, the labor newspaper as well as the nice establishment Troy Times, all 3 papers have notices not only of her death but also her funeral, and varying degrees of information, but we have a whole list of all the pallbearers: John Freeman, Garrett Farrell, Patrick Fitzgerald, George Kelly, Thomas Brady, Patrick Delaney, Thomas Burke, August Gear, Patrick Leach, and Father McDuff and Father Mahoney were the clergy in charge. Very much Irish, very much a neighborhood thing. She's listed in her obituaries as being resident in that one area of Troy most of her life, the Collared and Cuff District. There's actually, in the surrogate court records, there's documents from her funeral, the funeral expenses. She owed about $140 in taxes for that year, and they spent $190 on her funeral. She was buried in a solid oak casket, fully lined, with a pillow and handles. They had a hearse and 4 carriages for the funeral procession. They also purchased a black dress and black gloves to bury her. The document also lists 3 dozen chairs which were rented for the funeral. So I'm not sure again where were those chairs used. She had a $1,000 life insurance policy which was cashed in. Once they paid back taxes and funeral expenses and some bills, her 2 sisters inherited $600 between the 2 of them. And 4 years later, 1910, Both of her sisters died within 6 months of each other. She had two nephews and a niece. George was a steam fitter. He also died in an accident in 1910. Mary, a niece who was a clerk at one point, she dies in 1912. And George, who's another clerk, dies in 1929. None of those nephews or niece had any children that we know of. John actually married, but we see no record of family. So the family trail ends in the direct line by 1929. And of course, the questions continue. What else is there out there? What other family members? We need to research the secondary cousins and the other stories. There was no headstone on Kate Mullaney's grave, none for any of the family, in fact. All of the family members are buried in three plots up at St. Peter's, right next to the road. And actually, Austin Devane and some others are actually working now on a committee to get some sort of marker for that grave, again, to let her story and her final resting place be better known. Kate is coming back into focus. We're learning more about her, but Kate is only one of the thousands of workers that worked here in Troy and over in Cohoes and in any of the industries throughout this area. Each of us has a family story to tell. I know someone brought a picture of his father or grandfather who has worked in one of the iron foundries. There are other family pictures floating around in attics and basements. The Historical Society, the Public Library have all been collecting these things. There's talk of a National Labor Studies Center here in the area. And in fact, out on the table you may have picked up a flyer for the Troy and Cohoes Work and Community History Project. Jerry Zahavi from SUNY History Department is working with his students and will be doing oral histories of people, recording these stories before it's too late. Tom Carroll spoke at one point about the gateway, Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway. When they opened their buildings, headquarters down in the old Burden Ironworks, in the early years, they'd have maybe 10 or 12 men a year stop by looking for permission to come into the main headquarters where the president had his offices. As workers, they had never been allowed inside the president's building. They could get their paycheck from the edges. The first couple of years that building was open to the public as the Gateway Museum, there were, like, as I said, 10 to 12 people a year. Last year, no one came. It dwindled down to one or two a year, and now none. Another generation is dying. More stories are getting lost. So if I've sparked anyone's interest, there's lots of research to be done, lots of stories to be told, and lots of stories that are worth recording. So I welcome your input, I welcome your presence, and let's keep going. Thank you so much.